Welcome to The Daily Stoic, where each day we read a short passage designed to help you cultivate the strength, insight, wisdom necessary for living the good life. Each one of these passages is based on the 2,000-year-old philosophy that has guided some of history's greatest men and women. For more, you can visit us at dailystoic.com.
I've talked a lot about my morning routine here. One of the things I do every morning after I get up is I take a bunch of vitamins that my doctor recommended after some blood tests. I take a vitamin C, a zinc, a omega-3, and I take a couple others who I'm forgetting, but I definitely know whose vitamins I take. And they actually happen to be today's sponsor, and I've been taking them long before Thorne sponsored today's episode. Thorne takes a personalized, innovative, and scientific approach to health and wellness with all their supplements, and they've teamed up with leading medical professionals to bring out highly effective nutritional supplements. Because I'm a runner, I'm always trying to take care of my joints. And with Thorne, I never have to question what's in each supplement. Give your body what it really needs with Thorne. Go to thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your first order. That's thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your order. thorne.fit/dailystoic. Use code dailystoic. And note, these statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. The Daily Stoic is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. One of the cool things about podcasts is that you can multitask while you're listening, but depending on what you're doing right now, like for instance, if you're not in some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you could be doing. You could be getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $700 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 29 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $698 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. Hey, it's Ryan. Welcome to another episode of the Daily Stoic podcast. Obviously, we talk a lot here on this show, in my writings, in the Daily Stoic email, about the works of the classics, not just the Stoics, but the classic literature, you know, Homer, Virgil, Shakespeare. That, you know, can be intimidating and a bit foreign to people. Obviously, it wasn't to the Stoics, as I talk about in Lives of the Stoics. One of the Stoics, I believe it was Chrysippus, was such a fan of Euripides' Medea that he said he quoted the entirety of Medea in one of his books. And you can't help it when you read Marcus Aurelius or Seneca, notice just how much classical literature plays, books, poems, they quote. And you know, if we assume that Marcus Aurelius is doing this, you know, in his journal, that means he's probably doing a lot of it from memory. That's how sort of familiar they were with these things. And then as you get later in history, you know, Shakespeare sort of replaces some of the ancients. But the classics loom large in the great works of philosophy and history and literature. And, you know, I went to a good public school, but certainly was not like some rock star student. I went to a decent, you know, college before I dropped out. But I didn't really get introduced to these texts in school. It was reading I did on my own. The Stoics are in some ways deceiving because they're so easy to read that you think, oh, I can pick up these other texts. And the reality is they are a bit tougher. And so I have sort of had to work up my own understanding of this literature and my own way through it, not having the benefit of a teacher or parents who are teaching it or class of students or a study group. I've had to sort of cobble together my own methodology. We talk a little bit about this in our Read to Lead course, but whether it's using Wikipedia or articles or watching videos or asking smart people that I know or just trying really hard to get it, I've sort of had to work through my own way of understanding them. And it's been immensely rewarding. My knowledge of the classics sort of has shaped who I am as a person. It's shaped how I am as a father. It shapes how I write. It shapes how I think. It shaped my understanding of politics. And so I wanted to have today's guest on because I was interested in, obviously, the classics, but how does one teach the classics? And
what can we learn from someone who did not, let's say, go to a private school as a kid that taught Latin, which, you know, and private tutors, someone who whose sort of own understanding of the classics was equally autodidactic. And so my guest today is Professor Angel Adams Parnum, who is a professor actually of sociology at Loyola University in New Orleans. Her day job work, let's call it, as her bio says, engages in the intersection of race, migration, identity, and natural belongings. And she has a particular interest in communities and cultures of the U.S. South and the Caribbean. And she went to University of Wisconsin. She went to Yale. So she's a professor of sociology, but she does all sorts of interesting work here in the teaching of classics. Dr. Angel Adams Parnum is the co-founder and executive director of the Nyasa Classical Community, which provides after-school programming and curriculum designed to connect with and draw students of color into the beauty of classical literature and what we talk about in our talk as the great conversation, instead of seeing it as the Western canon, which can seem a little bit sort of nationalistic, if you will. The more inclusive term is the idea of the great conversation. And so her understanding of sociology combines with her Christian faith, with her understanding of the classics, and with her experience homeschooling two girls in what they call the classical Christian tradition, which is a sort of a Christian-based way of teaching the great texts of history. So she is a fascinating thinker. We had a great conversation. As you know, I lived in New Orleans for a number of years when I was writing my first book. It's a city that I have an immense amount of fondness for, a city that itself is sort of rooted in and inspired by classical literature. Even there's Mardi Gras cruise named after, you know, classical ideas. There's streets named after the muses in New Orleans. It is a classical city, if there ever was one in America, probably next to Boston, our most classical city. So this is a great conversation. I really appreciate Dr. Parnum taking the time to talk with me. It was awesome. One of my favorite ones to date. And if you want to support the Nyasa Classical Community, you can do that. That's Nyasa, N-Y-A-N-S-A, classicalcommunity.org. It's a great organization. You can donate to them as well. It's a 501c3 in the state of Louisiana. And so all your gifts are tax deductible. You can check that out. Appreciate you listening. And I'll talk to you soon. So I was curious, how did you get introduced to the classics, which you now are such a big proponent of? Was it in school or did it happen somewhere else?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. It did not happen in school at all, you know, despite the fact that I have spent an inordinate number of years in school through college, graduate school, and so on. It was not actually until I started educating my own children that I got into it.
So you got into it with your own children. Why don't you think you learned about it in school? Do you think it is that an educational trend, or is it just the track that you were on, or did you, were you just not interested?
That's a good question. You know, I'm trying to think. I'm sure as a child, I knew something at least of Greek mythology, you know, at the very least. I had some dim awareness. I don't remember specifically, you know, where I might have learned some of the Greek mythology. But other than that, I would say I do not recall learning any kind of classic literature K-12. I was certainly introduced, say, to Chaucer in high school, so more medieval literature. And sure. I was entranced by Chaucer. And it was because my teacher at the time, I think I was in 11th grade, he did this dramatic entry into the classroom. So we're sitting there in our English class, and he walks in, and rather dramatically, he begins to recite. And he says, "Wandara prul with his shurasota, the druid of March hath passed to the rota." And it was just so compelling and so dramatic. And as you can see, all these years later, I still remember it. And so we memorized some lines from Chaucer. And that did cinch for me wanting to study English literature initially. And so I gave my heart to English literature, went off to college, actually took some Latin Yeah, so I guess I have to make a correction. It's not that I didn't get any kind of exposure. So I went, and I can't remember if I took one semester or two semesters of Latin. I believe it was my first year, and it was just terrible. And the reason it was terrible is because everyone in the class seemed to have gone to, I don't know where they went, probably fancy prep schools, you know, being that it was Yale.
Sure.
And I just went to my, you know, regular public high school, very good public high school, but just, you know, not the same kind of background that many of my peers would have had at Yale. And it became very clear from the beginning that everyone had already studied Latin for a number of years. But this was the lowest introductory course to Latin you could take. So I was really confused and discouraged. And I thought, well, I guess I'm not meant to be here. The teacher was a graduate student, and she seemed all on board with, you know, everybody already knew a lot of the basics. She wasn't trying to slow down for people like me. So I went from wanting to study ancient languages, you know, committed to studying Latin. I had already also decided I was going to study the language of Chaucer. I really went in all in my freshman year, talked my way into advanced English courses, and I was going to do these languages. And it just didn't happen, you know, and it felt very discouraging. Now that I am interestingly kind of immersed in a different way in the world of classical education, and I'm in conversation with classicists, which I don't put myself into the community of classicists, but for some of the work I do read classicists and, you know, listen to talks by classicists and so on. And what I now understand is that it's not uncommon for folks from non-white and non-wealthy backgrounds to feel very discouraged going into classics. And so I, being African-American, you know, coming from, I'd say maybe a lower middle class home, you know, average public school education. Like I said, I was confronted with a very different scene where it didn't seem like that was a place that I was meant to be, even though I went into the lowest level Latin you could go into.
There's a lot to unpack there. I think it's really interesting. It's one, I think you make a great point about the power that just one teacher or one person who really gets material can make on a young person by making it accessible, by making it exciting. The fact that you could recount that all these years later, I mean, there's not a better testament to, one, I think, the power of literature, but also the power of teachers.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
And I think it comes down also to how the classics are taught. And I think, obviously, your point about race is well made. But the reality is most people don't find the classics super inviting, even if it is, you know, sort of very much their quote-unquote wheelhouse. And I wonder how much of that has to do with how we teach the classics. Are we teaching them as literature? Are we teaching them as a sort of a place for moral clarity and insight? What, obviously, my background is more in the Stoics, and there's this scene in one of Seneca's letters where he's talking about the Odyssey, and he's talking about how the Odyssey is taught to children. And I thought you would like this. He says, "We haven't time to spare to hear whether it was between Italy and Sicily that Ulysses ran into a storm, or somewhere outside the world we know, when every day we're running into our own storms, spiritual storms, and driven by vice into all the troubles that Ulysses ever knew." His point being, you read the Odyssey not because it's beautiful language, not to memorize the facts and figures and characters' names, but because it's supposed to teach you how to be better in the world. Mm. And it strikes me that's not really how the classics are taught most of the time.
I think you're right about that. I was listening to a speaker who was, I can't remember her exact topic, but I listened to a lot of different classical education conference speakers, authors, and so on. And the person that I was listening to earlier today was saying something along the lines of, even something like poetry has been ruined often in schools, you know, rather than it being something to delight, you know, rather than reading to delight in it or reading to get swept up in the adventure or reading to have a better understanding of who I am as a human being and what kind of human being I'm going to be as I look at these other people's struggles or adventures, rather than it being about that, it becomes about this kind of dry dissection, you know, and this kind of dry literary analysis. I think that is a big part of the issue. And we live in a culture that is so bound up with quantification. Everything has to be minutely quantified, measured, compared. You know, the very way our, especially our public school system is set up, is relentlessly quantifying at just about every stage. I recall speaking with a friend here in New Orleans who was teaching kindergarten in a public school. And she told me very proudly, you know, that she was doing these ongoing assessments all day long, collecting data on the children all day, many assessments, and, you know, responding to the data of the assessments and so on. And she was excited about this. I was horrified. You know, it's not that there isn't a place for assessment. Certainly there is a place for assessment. But, you know, this is part of the reason that we homeschool. We are not wealthy enough to, you know, send our kids to, you know, some great private school that we might like that has all the bells and whistles. And then I'm not really at all satisfied with what's going on in the public schools. But the way my children's education was, I took my oldest out when she was in pre-K-4. And it was just rich literature, just reading stories and being immersed in stories. And I'll never forget that my four-year-old, so at the time, this was a couple years before I got specifically into classical education, and I was using a curriculum called Sunlight, which is basic, it's a homeschool company, and they basically deliver school in a box to you, all of the books, you know, all everything for science, math. However, they're wonderful in that they're very literature rich. And so I would be reading my four-year-old these Uncle Wiggily stories. And I don't know if you or any of your listeners have ever heard of Uncle Wiggily. He's a rabbit. And I had never heard of Uncle Wiggily in my life. So it's this volume of stories of Uncle Wiggily's exploits. And it's pretty much no illustrations. There is the occasional black and white pencil illustration, but it's pretty much just dense prose. But it's children's stories. And I would read these Uncle Wiggily stories, and she would sit with rapt attention for 20 minutes or more, a four-year-old, listening. You know, to me, that's what a 4 or 5-year-old should be doing, is listening to and getting lost in wonderful literature.
And how have you approached that with your own children? If people are listening, they have young children, or if your understanding of the classics is at a children's level, like you've never really dove into it, how have you thought about sort of getting like somebody's feet wet as far as diving into this huge body of work?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. For me, you know, I like to say that I entered the world of classics through the back door. You know, it didn't quite work for me to go in through the front door. And then I was invited by a friend to go to Classical Conversations, which is a classical education group. And that's when I started. And so as I started to kind of wrap my head around what it was and this idea of reading classic works of literature, you know, I started to get my introduction to Homer. And I had the guidance of other homeschool parents, you know, who were ahead of me in this. And kind of the approach that they suggested was to start out with a children's picture book version of a classic. And I can actually recommend Gillian Cross's illustrated version of the Iliad and the Odyssey. They're two separate picture books, and they are just wonderful. So it was Gillian Cross's picture books that were my first version of the Iliad and the Odyssey. And so I think my kids, when we first read them, because we go in 3-year cycles, starting with the ancient world 1 year, the medieval world and the Renaissance the next year, and then the modern world the 3rd year. So I believe my children might have been something like maybe 5 and 8 when we read the Odyssey, this children's version of the Odyssey. And I can guarantee any adult will be very comfortable, you know, reading this. And she gets the kind of the crux of the core stories, and they're just really engagingly told. The illustrations are wonderful. And from that, you know, even as an adult, I got swept up in the story.
Sure.
And then the next stage is, you know, you kind of just gradually get more complex versions of that same classic work of literature. So for instance, the following year, we were in the medieval and the Renaissance period. And so I introduced Shakespeare to my kids. So they were, you know, somewhere around 6 to 9 or 10, something like that. And I teach them together. So the older and the younger were reading the same thing. And I always read aloud because I want them, you know, they're even the picture books are still going to be somewhat above what they feel comfortable reading. So I just want them to get lost in the story and the language read well. And then they have different books that they're working on for their own literacy. But there's a wonderful edition of Shakespeare, Charles Lamb and Mary Lamb, Tales from Shakespeare. It's a Signet classic.
Okay. Yeah, I like the Signet classic editions myself.
Yes. So it's a retelling, a prose retelling of Shakespeare. And so it's not written in play form at all. You know, it's like short stories, you know, a short story version of Romeo and Juliet, you know, many other of the core works of Shakespeare. And so I have these two young girls and, you know, we're reading Shakespeare stories. Now, fast forward some years later, this past year that just finished, we were back in the medieval Renaissance again. And so they had been introduced to Shakespeare all those years ago. They remember some of the core stories. And so this time I got, you know, just your standard Shakespeare original language, all of that. I got an annotated version so we could have some notes. The language is difficult, but they already had the core stories because we had already done those stories in a modern English prose version.
Sure.
What was so interesting for me this year, so this year that just finished, they were 10 and 13. All right. So we're reading the original Shakespeare. We did Romeo and Juliet, Othello, and The Taming of the Shrew. So I had planned to do 1 or 2 Shakespeare plays this year. We would read it. And then every Friday we would watch, you know, on television or on YouTube, we'd watch whatever we had read, we would watch that much of it so that it was reinforced visually. And to my delight and surprise, you know, I thought, okay, well, we, you know, we did a play. That's great. We have some other things to do. And they just clamored for more Shakespeare. You know, like I just could not get them away from Shakespeare. So we did 1 play, we did 2 plays. I'm like, okay, so we've done a couple, you know, we still need to get to Milton. No, we've got to do more Shakespeare. So we did another Shakespeare play. So we did 3 Shakespeare plays back to back, from the beginning to the end, original language, you know, kind of working through what does it mean? How do we translate to today's English? And I think it's just a testament to this kind of tiered approach of just introducing the stories in a super accessible form for children, but also for adults who don't have this background. And then you as the adult, you, as your children are growing up, you are also growing in your knowledge of this literature.
I think that makes a lot of sense. I mean, what I often tell people when I'm sort of, because I have no training in the classics, but have sort of slowly made my way through the canon. What I often do is I'll sort of start with the Wikipedia page and I just want to get my head around what happens. Yes. and who the characters are, why they're doing what they do, what the main themes are, then I'll maybe watch, yeah, as you said, I'll watch a movie or a version of it being acted out. Then I'll read articles about it. And then you go and read it. And I think the other part of your strategy, which I'm now just going through myself, which you sort of have figured out with your kids, I think makes a lot of sense, is if we think about how people would have consumed Homer in the ancient world or Shakespeare in the 1800s, it was not a one and done thing, because a library in a home might only have like 10 or 15 books. So you would have interacted with the thing over and over again. So I first read, you know, chunks of the Odyssey in high school. Then I read the Robert Fagel's translation, you know, maybe 10 years ago. And then last year, Emily Wilson, who's a wonderful scholar, I think at Princeton, and has done a biography of Seneca, she came out with a new translation of the Odyssey, and I read that. Mm-hmm. And so that's now my third or fourth time reading it in some form or another. And I was amazed at all the things I got having read a thing that I've already read all these times. Like, for instance, I didn't know, I just assumed like the story ends when he got home, right? Like he's reunited with his wife. I was just writing about this recently. It didn't occur to me until I'd read it all these times that the end of the Odyssey is Homer leaving, or is Odysseus leaving again. Mm-hmm. And that actually, and then I read the Tennyson poem again, and you realize, oh, maybe this thing that I thought was this sort of story about adventure is actually, you know, as an adult, I'm interpreting it more as the story of a man sort of imprisoned by his own restlessness. And so mm-hmm. I think the interaction with the material over and over again, that's how the classics historically have been in people's lives. It wasn't one book you read among many other books. It's the book in the way that you would read the Bible many times in your life.
Right. No, I think that's completely on the mark. And I think it also gets at kind of one's philosophy of education and literature and what literature is for or what education is for. You know, and again, to go back to, I think the larger tendency in our culture is more quantifying, checking mm-hmm. off the list. Okay, we've met this objective. All right, you're now educated. Yeah. Rather than dwelling in that world, yes. Rather than kind of cultivating this whole thought world and living with it and, you know, using it in various ways and recognizing in everyday human conduct and experience something that resonates with you from some of this literature that you've read, you know, it's a dwelling in. It's not just, okay, I read it.
No, and I think when you really do dwell in it the way that it was intended, it unlocks all these things that you didn't realize were happening. I was telling you this when we first connected. I'd lived in New Orleans for 2 or 3 years, I think 2 years, before I was reading Stephen Pressfield's book, The War of Art, when he pointed out that there were streets named after the nine muses along, I think it's St. Charles Avenue in New Orleans. And you go, oh, this would have been immediately obvious to someone who had grown up in the classics. And so one of the things I think you unlock when you study these texts, whether it's a play by Euripides or Shakespeare, or whether it's Homer, or, you know, it's Tacitus's histories, is you end up unlocking all the art and literature and things that came after that were formed by people who were influenced by that. So you pick up on all these allusions and references and homages that 500 years of reading Shakespeare have created for people.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, we miss so much in modern work when we don't have that foundation in classic literature. And, you know, there's so much that's lost that I think is really tragic. You know, one is the simple ability to understand much modern literature. And the other is, you know, just the a thought world that is relatively bereft, you know, or that is kind of just filled with mindless amusements, but with very little that is lasting and nourishing to the soul.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. We push what technology can do so great ideas can happen now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now.
Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing access to affordable sexual health treatments from the comfort of your couch. It's always sensitive talking about these things, but Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing access to doctor-trusted ED treatments such as chewable hard mints, brand name treatments like Viagra, or generic alternatives for up to 95% cheaper. The process is simple and 100% online. No uncomfortable doctor's visits. If prescribed, your medication ships to you for free. No insurance needed. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/TDS. That's hims.com/TDS for your personalized ED treatment options. Hard mints are a chewable compounded products which are not approved by or verified for safety or effectiveness by the FDA. Prescriptions require an online consultation with your healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for details and important safety information. Subscription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan.
Yeah, you know, you look at most children's books, for instance, and they're funny and entertaining and bright, you know, have bright photos and everything. Then I can track, like when you look at old history books and, you know, like something like the story of George Washington chopping down the cherry tree, that's obviously not as exciting as a pizza birthday party with, you know, supernatural figures and, you know, all the craziness in a kid's book. But the reason they were telling that story, even though it's not strictly true, was to really teach something important. And I think that's another thing we lose when we sort of just focus on how entertaining is a piece of literature.
Absolutely. There's this really wonderful book by Vigen Guroian called Tending the Heart of Virtue. And the subtitle is How Classic Stories Awaken a Child's Moral Imagination. Ooh. And I highly recommend this book. And what he does is to really kind of flesh out exactly what you just said. You know, what is it that, why is it that we read these classic stories? You know, what do you get out of it? And he talks about how, dwelling in story and metaphor helps us, young children especially, to think about, you know, the truth of what it means to be human, of what kind of person we want to be or, you know, don't want to be, of these larger issues of, you know, love and goodness and evil, you know, that is what those stories do. And I think we have lost an interest in our culture in cultivating this kind of moral imagination. You know, again, it comes down to quantifying, you know, it's all about quantifying and, you know, what are the test scores and, you know, how prestigious are the colleges that the kids get into. And that's the mark of a good education, rather than, you know, what kind of people are we cultivating with this education?
I'm curious, how do you, because what's interesting about these texts as sort of vessels for virtue and sort of inculcating these sort of values of Western civilization, the sort of, it's so, I find that to be so inspiring and it's been so informative for me. And then of course, also, it's really easy to lose sight of, you know, the hypocrisy that looms over all of these works. I'm curious, like in a city like New Orleans, with your background in sociology as an African American, how do you talk to your kids about the things that are not talked about in these books, or in contrast, some of the bad things that are talked about in these books? How do you suggest parents think about that, and how do we deal with that as a culture?
Yeah, well, I do think that's a very important part of it. I think, you know, you have to deal with it head on. You know, some of it depends on the age of the children as well. But from a very early age, you know, I've just been straightforward with my kids. You know, when we're looking at a situation, say we're looking at the issue of slavery, you know, just talking through, what does that mean? You know, what does that mean for someone to be enslaved? You know, what do you think about that? Why would that happen? You know, you have to, from an early age, talk those things through. And I think the other reason, you know, one of the big reasons that the classics have been so in decline is because there are objections based on these very understandable critiques, right? You know,
that it's all old white guys.
That's right. And I think the critique is understandable, but I don't think that that means that, okay, we shouldn't read any of this. And here's why. I think one has to have a broader understanding of the classics and what they can do. And so this idea of awakening moral imagination or using them to think about ourselves in grander terms. So anyone who knows anything about the Black intellectual tradition and classic writers of that tradition, so Frederick Douglass, for instance, and W.E.B. Du Bois, Anna Julia Cooper, Phyllis Wheatley, these are some of the kind of heavy hitters in terms of Black writers. All of them were immersed in the same classic literature, all of them.
Sure.
And yet they got something incredibly inspiring out of it. You know, certainly there are things there that are not inspiring and that are hypocritical and that are problematic. Well, they didn't use those parts of them, right? You know, they took the parts that were nourishing and that were transformative. And that is what made the difference for them. So Frederick Douglass, for instance, he got his hands on a volume called The Columbian Orator, which was filled with, you know, these great speeches. And when he was a young boy, that's what he used to train himself to read and to speak persuasively. And in The Columbian Orator, there is a dialogue called Dialogue Between a Master and a Slave. And in that dialogue, the slave is basically explaining to the owner, you know, why this is just a bad deal for both of them. You know, how they're both being demeaned by this situation and how, it, you know, liberty is the way that you have to go. And so this also awakened in him, you know, of course, he already knew the institution of slavery was a problem, but it just strengthened his conviction all the more. There is, in reading Du Bois, you know, he's got all kinds of classic references all throughout The Souls of Black Folk and his other writing as well. Same with Phyllis Wheatley. So I just think it's really short-sighted to say, well, you know, it's mainly white men who have written this, and, you know, some of them were slave owners and some of them were really horrible people, so we just shouldn't read their ideas at all. Well, what about, you know, non-white people, particularly African Americans, who have read this same literature and who have used it to great effect in liberatory ways? So I think it's all about exactly how do we read this literature. And we have to guide our children in ways that they read it not to reinforce the inequalities we already have, but to generate conversations. And my favorite way of doing this, particularly when you start to get to the upper levels of, say, 7th through 12th grade, is to put these texts into dialogue with each other. You know, so read some of the core texts, you know, Aristotle, Plato, in dialogue with writers like Du Bois and Frederick Douglass, for instance. One of my favorite things to pair is to look at Plato's Allegory of the Cave, for instance, and, you know, just kind of the power of education is one way that you can interpret that. And
our obligation to, once we discover truth, to spread it, as opposed to sort of run off. That's why I've always taken that allegory.
Exactly, exactly. You know, so you can read the Allegory of the Cave together with, say, Frederick Douglass's narrative, where he has this eye-opening passage about what it meant to his personhood and his soul to learn how to read. You know, there's so much you can do with that type of rich dialogue. Unfortunately, I don't usually see that happening what you usually see is, you know, two extremes. One that says we have to defend this canon, you know, at all costs, and, you know, just forget about all the critics. And then you have, on the other hand, this is a horrible racist group of readings and writers, and we just should cast them off. And that is not how Black intellectuals process this. You know, I'm thinking here 18th and 19th century. That's not how they process it at all. And, you know, even going into the 20th century, Martin Luther King, very much, again, immersed in the classics. These are people that we would never critique for, you know, reinforcing racist hierarchies.
No, I think you're right. And what I've got goosebumps hearing you talk about it, because that's been my experience, obviously, as a white person. But you end up reading these books, and then you read Frederick Douglass, or you read Booker T. Washington, or you read Ralph Ellison, or Richard Wright, and you realize that it's been this long tradition of the torch being passed, and that the really great writers managed to go, hey, you guys have been reading that tradition wrong this whole time. Like, to me, what Frederick Douglass does is he goes back to the Greeks and the philosophers and to the founding fathers, and he reinterprets all of the material in a way that is more inclusive and more eye-opening, in the same way that Lincoln, who wasn't particularly religious, goes to the Bible and finds a stronger argument to the country in the moral condemnation of slavery. And so what I've always, as a lover of books, I think what I find so comforting and inspiring is this sense that you're picking up the same book that millions of people have picked up for thousands of years. And we're all trying to get closer to those ideals, even if the person writing it could have had no conception of the progress that we've made or want to make.
Absolutely. And I think that's right. There is something so powerful about picking up that same piece of literature. And I think, you know, people talk about this in different ways. Some people talk about Western civilization. Some people talk about the Western canon. Another way that is perhaps more inviting is the great conversation.
Oh, sure.
You know, when you think of it and frame it in terms of a great conversation, you know, exactly. Aristotle is part of it. Cicero is part of it, but so is Frederick Douglass and Phyllis Wheatley.
Yes.
You know, they're all part of this great conversation. And then so are we, and so are our children. You know, so it's this invitation to this conversation. And now it is our turn to introduce it to our children so that they can become part of the conversation. There's something very worrisome to me about we're just going to pretend the conversation never happened. You know, we're just going to make our own new conversation and not make any reference to what's been happening the past 3,000 years. You know, we have writers of such genius who have crystallized such important aspects of the human experience. And rather than drawing on, critiquing, refining that wisdom, we're just saying, you know, we now are kind of the measure of everything, so we don't need any of that.
Or weirdly, yeah, it's not even, hey, let's have a new conversation, because what I often find will happen is, say you put together a list of, you know, great plays or great classics, or you look at the list that you've been talking about of texts, and you go, oh, that's all old white guys. And that's the end of the conversation, because there's never hey, let me replace it with these five better, more diverse texts, because I would love to read those if they exist, but it's often a way of shutting down the conversation without replacing it. And I feel like one of my arguments politically has been, why are we in a scenario where our norms are so collapsed, where we don't have a common language to be able to come together and say, this is wrong, this is beyond the pale, this is okay, this is, you know, in the middle, let's discuss it, is that we no longer have a canon that we all agree as expressing sort of who we are and what we want to believe in. And so it's certainly fine, I think, to remove certain texts or authors, you know, if we decide, hey, this isn't appropriate anymore, this isn't who we want to be anymore, or this is flawed for this reason or that reason. But who are you going to elevate to the canon is also an important discussion. We don't seem to be able to have that either.
That's right. And I think the conversation does just stop at these are people from oppressive backgrounds, full stop. I think sometimes there is an attempt to replace with writers from different perspectives and experiences, and I think that's fine. And I think it's important to have writers of various perspectives, you know, because if you're trying to get to the essence of what is freedom, say, you would want to include African-American writers in that discussion, right?
Sure.
You know, if we're really trying to get to the essence of what is the idea of freedom or citizenship, you cannot fully have that conversation without incorporating African-American writers. But then you also need writers who have been from the long established core in that conversation. You need both of them. It's not an either or. And in his book, On the Great Conversation, Robert Hutchins, he starts the book out by saying, you know, we are going to need to kind of sift and winnow this core. You know, we'll periodically have to determine that some are going to come out. Maybe they just haven't been as useful, and new ones are going to go in. Now, he may not have had any idea that who we might nominate for that core now. He might not be in agreement. Who knows? But as you said, there has to be a conversation about it rather than getting rid of the idea of a core at all.
Well, and I think, I'm sure you don't have an unlimited amount of time, so although I could talk to you about this for hours, when I think about that great conversation and how it's endured over history, you go, what is freedom? Well, maybe you start with Epictetus, a freed slave in Rome, and then that gets you to Toussaint Louverture, who is a slave in Haiti and leads a rebellion, but reads Epictetus. Right. And then where do the people that Toussaint inspired get you, whether it's in New Orleans or in the American South? And so it really does become, I think, that idea of torches passing, and you see how the things influence each other. And you get, as you said, you get these different perspectives by looking at it from all these different ways. And I think it should be additive rather than subtractive.
That's right. No, I'm all for it. And, you know, it grieves me that that's not what we have. That is not the default at the K-12 level. And sadly, in many universities, that is not the approach. You know, even when you look at general education requirements, very few colleges is everyone going to be reading some core of classic literature that puts, you know, contemporary text and diverse authors into conversations with this core. So you just have this situation where, you know, many people just never read these writers, because why would you? You know, no one's ever suggested you should read them. And it's just kind of a takeout menu of courses that you're going to take in college. You know, other than the major, which is going to try to anchor and channel the study, there's nothing that coheres together. And I think it really is a problem.
And though I think to bring this to a close, what the Stoics would say is that although, you know, very few of us have the ability to influence, you know, the educational policy at the federal level or the state level or the city level. And so much of this sort of direction or drift or decline is outside of our control. What is in our control is how we teach and educate our own children. And I think that's what's so inspiring about the work that you're doing with your family, but then also as you've written about and sort of been a leader in this space, is like, we can complain about it, or we can start where we have the most influence, which is in our own home. And hopefully if enough people do that, it can keep the torch lit, as the expression goes.
I think that's right. So, you know, I did start with my own daughters, and that has been just wonderful to be able to do that. But then I also realized that not everyone has the privilege or the flexibility. And so I live in a lower income African-American neighborhood. And with a friend, we co-founded an organization that does classical education in our community with kids whose parents are really struggling. They're going to your, you know, local public schools. They're not getting any of this. And so for the past 5 years, with this organization, it's called Nyansa Classical Community, we have been reading Homer, we've been reading Greek mythology, and then, you know, kind of like I've suggested, we've intertwined that with the study of African American traditions as well. And so that, like what you're saying, you know, what is it that you have control over? So it is my family, and then also, because I'm in a position of privilege, to be able to take this also out into the community as well.
Professor, thanks so much. I love it. And thank you for taking the time.
Thank you.
If you're liking this podcast, we would love for you to subscribe. Please leave us a review on iTunes or any of your favorite podcast listening apps. It really helps. And tell a friend.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Daily Stoic early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen early and ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts.
Do you want to hear about the $100 wedding dress that just saved Abercrombie?
Or the tech acquisition that was just like Game of Thrones?
Or the one financial equation that can solve climate change?
Then check out our daily podcast, The Best One Yet, or as we call it, T-Boy.
This is Nick.
This is Jack.
And we pick the three most interesting business news stories every day for the perfect mix.
20 minutes each morning, you're going to feel brighter.
We call it Pop Biz, don't we, Jack?
Where pop culture meets business news. So whether you want to kick off a conversation with your buddies,
or you're going for that promotion at work,
or you just want to know the trends before your friends,
feel brighter by starting your morning with us every weekday.
Listen to The Best One Yet on the Wondery app or wherever you get your pods.
You can listen to The Best One Yet ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts.
With shows like The Best One Yet, How I Built This, and many more, Wondery means business.